back, WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are keeping calm, we're staying local, and we are doing Arts Week on all things BP. Don Mahler joining us here from Catonsville in the 21228, where at some point I'm going to make some essential stops over to State Fair for perhaps some chicken and waffles to go. At this point, it might be the shrimp and grits, Don, I'm not sure. And I know you enjoyed some Fadley's crab cakes as well last week and sending those in. And we had your son, Jeff Mahler from Mahler and Gary Realty, on last week as well. Don, how are you holding up a month into this thing here?
We're doing as well as anyone can do. As you said, it's uncharted waters for us all. We apologize to everybody on the front end and to our guest today for recognizing that the sound quality of our production, with me being at a distance, isn't what it normally is. But we will be back one of these days, and in the meantime, we're delighted to really nest to celebrate the arts, and today to welcome in the director of the Baltimore Museum of Art, Chris Bedford. Chris, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we've been doing this about a week and a half, 2 weeks into this, so this isn't our first conversation with anyone that has been displaced. Don's idea after education was to focus on the arts. We're going to be getting to the hospitals and the banking industry and other businesses as I've been welcoming them in. But set us up with where the BMA is at this point for any of the museums out there. A lot of online, a lot of educational, and folks that, and I think for every part of our life, if you are a part of museums and culture and going places and interacting, this has all been shut down, and your community is also displaced right now, correct?
Right, that's exactly correct. I mean, museums, particularly the BMA, given our very civic remit, we exist to serve people in space, and our objects are, of course, very physical, and we thrive on having bodies all in the same spaces, having conversations both pleasant and difficult about the most topical matters of today. So obviously having to close the museum, and I think rightly and justly, only 3 days after opening 10 absolutely extraordinary exhibitions, all focused on the achievements of female-identifying artists, was really, I think, psychologically challenging for the whole, 160, 165 people who work here at the museum. But we're a creative body. We're from top to bottom. And I think the charge that we've set ourselves is connecting with our audiences, broadly defined, from Baltimore all across the world, and making sure that what we extend through art is extended even during these most trying times. So we've been very creative about it, and we haven't lost touch with the very need-based focus of our program. So listening to our audiences, listening to artists, and trying to meet their need with the work that we do. So we're trying to do all of that in a very different world.
Well, Chris, you've been at the BMA now for about 4 years, right? You came in 2016.
Three and a half years, yeah.
3.5 years. You came from the Rose Museum in Oberlin. And one of the things, if folks get on and they Google Chris Bedford and they Google the BMA, one of the things that they're going to find out, and I was really struck by it, maybe you can talk a little bit about this, it certainly caught my eye, was that from day one, your passion has been to really open the museum up to folks who might not typically have experienced a museum, and to diversify its collection. I mean, that really jumps out at you. So can you talk a little bit about your passion to open it up
to new folks and
diversity?
Most certainly. I mean, it's a really fabulous question, and I thank you for it. So at the time when I made the decision, along with my family, to relocate to Baltimore, it was not the only option we were looking at. I was very interested in a big civic museum, but I was interested in one that wanted to reorient itself to really fulsomely and with real conviction face the needs and the interests of its immediate community. And so Baltimore stood out to me very radically. I believe that we're in the midst, we're the beneficiaries of an extraordinary golden generation of Black American artists that are redefining painting, sculpture, and the moving image, and are really socially invested, too, in the way that they operate as artists. And I'd spent the last 10 years or so working with that extraordinary generation. chief among them, very good friend and MacArthur Award-winning artist, et cetera, and so forth, Mark Bradford. So I was looking at for a context to marry those social convictions with a majority-minority city and a board that wanted to reorient the values of an institution to engage that city in its totality. And I found that in the BMA. And we've made equity and diversity the central spokes of absolutely everything we do. Every decision we make is fed through that value system. And so it's been an extraordinary 3.5 years. And nothing about the current circumstance deters us in that effort. We just need to be more inventive in reaching our publics, and that's the charge we've set ourselves.
Well, I'm trying to imagine, Chris, and maybe peel the curtain back a little bit for us, is that in 2018, this desire to diversify the BMA and really bring new artists to it was you decided to sell major works from really well-known artists that you had in the museum and use those proceeds to bring in different collections. Talk about that decision. Did you get pushback, and how has it worked out?
So, yes, we did make a decision to sell seven works, and those seven works were all by white male painters from the post-war period. And so... There is a way in which that story can be spun to seem maybe a little more radical than it actually is. So, yes, we wanted to build a war chest in order to diversify the story, the post-war story that we were able to tell, with a particular emphasis on men and women of color. And in order to do that, in order to be competitive in the marketplace, we needed to go to our existing resources, meaning our collection, and find those moments of poor quality or redundancy or storage burden that also had great value. So we did that analysis looking at our collection, landed on those seven works. And yes, of course, they're by white male artists because that is the preponderant majority of our collection. One thing we uncovered as we were doing research around our 2020 vision program focused on women was that we have... a 96% male collection. So, of course, the redundancy and the quality and the value are all going to lie in that area. So we looked at objects that weren't essential to the story we told that had great value. We sold them and were very, very fortunate at auction. And ever since, we've been able to enrich our collection substantially, diversify our collection substantially, and we believe that by the end of this whole enterprise, we'll have one of the greatest collections of post-war art by African Americans anywhere in the world. And that was the objective I set for myself.
You mentioned the story that you want to tell, and you mentioned these 10 exhibits that you had out for 72 hours when COVID took over all of our lives at this point.
Yeah.
Tell us about, in totality, those 10 exhibits, and certainly feel free to elaborate on any or all, right? But what goes into what makes an exhibit that passes your sniff test, as well as your board, as well as fits the storyline for, you know, where the BMA is going and where it's been as well?
Oh, well, first of all, we have an amazing brain trust at the museum. So I'm fortunate to have 23 curators, most of whom have PhDs. 21 of them are women. And
that's unusual, yes?
Probably the 21 of the 23 is a little bit unusual.
Okay.
Probably the fact that the majority of them have PhDs is a little bit unusual. I will say that we built that staff pretty vigorously over the last 3 years. So the curatorial division has been pretty radically restaffed, up to and including the chief curator. So those people are very naturally aligned with the direction that we're taking. And what I would say is that I trust them absolutely. They span our entire museum, so geography and time, and each one of them was charged with a creative way of engaging with a history of art as told through the imperatives of equity and diversity, with a particular focus on women, so that the creative program is all entirely due to their own industry and desire to put their best foot forward for the museum in a very special year. So, I feel very proud of it. I think it's a consequence of building a staff that collectively embraces a singular mission, and that has to do with social art history, telling human stories through art and connecting those human stories with the broadest and most diverse public imaginable.
Well, you've had a lot of stories to tell. I mean, you've lived in a lot of places and obviously have an interesting accent. I look on, I see a South African Cape Town background on one of the exhibitions that you were putting out. We're trying to get to South Africa. We're trying to just get to the airport at this point. You know, Chris, I think for anyone who's traveled, and Don's been through Europe, you know, through the last couple of years as well, and we spend lots of time in New York. We've talked about Broadway and things we like to do and the Pearl Jam concerts and the Rolling Stones concerts and all that. For someone like you that's been on and off of airplanes on a personal level, this is a trying period, I think, for any of us that have a wide experience of liking to have variety in our lives, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the I didn't realize how peripatetic and mobile I actually was until that option was taken fully and completely off the table. So, yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, I think that that is a loss in this period, that I consider myself and my occupation, intellectual interest, and the kind of reach I have through phone and through email and through Zoom to be so incredibly fortunate. I can't pity myself too much in this moment, but I will say, I think your comment really brings to light an interesting point, which is when this country eventually begins the steady and careful process of reopening itself, we as museums will be in a unique position to bring voices from all across the world to local communities, when I don't think travel will be free and clear to Europe, to Asia, to Africa, to Australia. But yet, the diversity of the exhibitions we have on view will allow our viewers right here access to all of that. And you mentioned Candice Bryce, who's a South African-born, Berlin-based moving image artist who looks at refugees and sex workers and does it with extraordinary sort of, you know, intellect and good humor and multimedia dazzle. So we're able to bring all of that to a very local situation. I think it's a big contribution that we can make and all museums can make when the world reopens.
Christopher Bedford is our guest. He is the director of the BMA, the Baltimore Museum of Art. You can learn about everything that they're doing and still lots of online things we can do at artbma.org, all part of our Arts Week, along with former county executive Don Moeller, who's now just telling art stories and sequestered over in Catonsville. Right, Don?
Absolutely. And Nestor, I don't know if you know this, and Chris, you may not know this about Nestor, but once upon a time, Nestor was actually a sports radio guy when we had sports to talk about. And when I look at your bio and your background, you're a young man that was born in England, right? Raised in Scotland in the United States, and found your way to Oberlin, Ohio, to play football. Is that accurate?
Well, that's correct. I actually went to Oberlin with the objective of majoring in English and swimming. And I ended up playing American football and majoring in art history. And both of those things became, you know, abiding passions and remain abiding passions. So,
Hold on here. I've got this is where the sports guy comes in here, and I put the NST hat on. So first things first, and for anybody around here that knows, you know, Baltimore sports, you would say, why would anyone with this kind of an accent like American football? And I'll say this, a guy stepped up to save my wife's life 6 years ago on the bone marrow rich. My wife's had leukemia. And the first thing that we found out about him when we found him on Facebook, and he's German, was that he loved the Pittsburgh Steelers. At least he thought he did until he met us. And I would say we were blown away by him and then all of his friends. And then, of course, 3 years ago, we went to Wembley with the Ravens contingent. We took 200 fans with us and part of that awful game that they had with the Jacksonville Jaguars. But on the subway alone, I saw all 32 jerseys. It's not that outlandish anymore for, I would say, a young person in Europe to understand the rules of American football, perhaps better than we understand rugby. And there'll be a quiz for Moeller at this at the end to see if he knows anything about rugby at all, or soccer for that matter, although we've had a lacrosse conversation lately. But Chris, American football, when does it come to you? And obviously you spent a lot of time in the States despite your accent and been, you know, you probably consider yourself as much American or are as American as anything your accent would say, but American football, when it comes to people that don't, especially baseball, when it doesn't come to you as a young person, it's kind of hard to explain, right?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, yeah, I would say that I came to the sort of physicality of the sport through rugby. Rugby was the sport I devoted myself to when I was living in England.
So, well, good. You can teach us the rules about that later, okay?
Yeah, that's going to be riveting. I'm sure your audience is going to love it.
And we're going to fail the quiz.
Yeah. So the physical intelligence of it, the physicality of it came to me through that sport. But yeah, you're absolutely correct. The simple idea of, you know, four downs, first and 10, it, formations on either side of the ball, special teams, none of that is native to a European context at all. And so it takes a tremendous amount of learning. I think by comparison, you know, there are some technicalities in soccer, but it's pretty straightforward. You have to put the ball in the net. And but American football is far, far more complex in scheming than that. And if you really want to appreciate the game, you actually do need to understand the technicalities. That's what makes it so complex and fascinating.
Now, you understand baseball too, then? You've picked that up?
My understanding of baseball is not as deep as my understanding of football, but I can certainly sit there for 3.5 hours and understand what's going on, yeah.
It took me a long time, and Don, I've told this story before. I worked in New York 20 years ago. I had a Swedish girlfriend. I took her to Yankee Stadium for Yankees-Red Sox, like a huge Pedro Martinez-Roger Clemens game, and I took on the task of trying to explain it to her. And when I said things like ball, strike, out, inning, she had a completely different context for the American. She spoke perfect English. Her English is better than mine, but she had no kind, and it was impossible. But I would hope that you could explain art to a guy from Dundalk in Catonsville better than we could explain baseball to a European, Chris, right?
I'm not exactly. I mean, you seem pretty adept at explaining things, but I actually think that part of the remit of this institution is to take the most complex ideas, or apparently most complex ideas, and make them broadly intelligible. So that, you know, that effort to translate something that exists in one space and make it available to everybody in another space, I think we're having the same conversation about art and sport. I think that's incredibly unusual. It's unusual to find people interested in both spheres. I very rarely find sports fans in the museum field. I very rarely find people who are students of art history in the sports field. So, you know, bringing the two together, I think, is incredibly fertile, particularly in a place like Baltimore that is as sports-obsessed as any city in America that I've lived in, with the possible exception of Boston.
Well, Don, he'll be happy to know that I'm the one sports guy that's seen the cone collection, right?
There you go. Yeah.
That excites me, Chris, tremendously.
Nestor loves to talk about the cone collection.
Well, I went when I was a kid, right? I mean, you know, we and this has been a theme, Chris, you know, that we all went to all of these places on a yellow school bus. John Schwartz was on from the Model Lyric, and I went there as a boy. True story, I met Don when I was a 14-year-old as my guidance counselor, so education has been a big part of my life, but going to these places when you're a kid, going to these places when you take a child, going to these places, as Don could tell you, once he reunites with his grandchildren and coming as a family, it becomes something different, I think, at every level, and if you haven't been to the BMA lately, you probably haven't been there much at all, right? I mean, things change and there's a real reason to come back, right?
Yeah, oh my gosh. And what we try and do, we try to be effervescent across the museum at all times, and then particularly in the context of 2020 and then heading into the middle part of 2021, our commitment around women artists is not just on the level of public programs and acquisitions. We're mounting a total of 23 exhibitions across the entire history of art throughout the course of that calendar year, which we've now made the decision to extend until the middle of 21. So every time you come to the museum, the likelihood is there's something new to see. And in addition to that, the great collections that anchor the institution in the more static way, principal among those, the Cone Collection. So I came here in large part because of the quality of the collection and the eagerness of the city to, embrace a fully civic museum. And so I think that weekend by weekend, what the BMA offers is as good as any museum in the world.
And Chris, we like to remind folks, and we're very proud, obviously, in Baltimore County to have been a small part of it, but that general admission is free. I mean, you can go to the BMA every single day, and general admission is free. Chris, is there a moment now in your 3.5 years when you look back, and anytime you move or relocate, there's always some trepidation. Is there a moment or an event or an encounter where you say to yourself, hey, right then I knew it was the right thing, that sticks out for you and you went, boy, did I make the right move?
I mean, on the honest answer to that is that remotely working in Boston, I always had my eye on this museum. And so when the opportunity came up, I knew it was the right one. And I have to say, with real conviction and honesty, it feels more right every single day. And it has to do with the nature and the texture of the city, an absolutely extraordinary board of trustees, and a really willing, eager, and able staff that's embraced the whole new vision for the institution and drives it absolutely relentlessly. So I feel, especially in the context of a troubled moment like this, very fortunate to have that big family around the leadership of the museum to ensure that when we emerge from this, we emerge even stronger. So I not for an instant have I ever wavered in the conviction that this is the right place.
Chris, that's interesting you say that, because you know, in the aftermath of Freddie Gray, one of the reasons we did Baltimore Positive long before they took sports away and we had a pandemic and we had a mayor who was indicted and any of that was part of the presidency of Trump coming in, but also just part of the aftermath of Freddie Gray and saying, I've been in Baltimore my whole life. Don has been here. We are both lifers. I will be 52 this year. Don's a little older than that, but not by much. At this point, and we love the place. And when I travel now, and none of us travel anymore, Chris, but when I was traveling in the last 2, 3, 4 years, I was going to cities like Cleveland, like Nashville, like Indianapolis, like Charlotte, places that I've been going my whole life, and saying, some of these places are really on the move. They're growing. You can see it. You can feel the vibrancy. You can feel people coming back to the city. You can feel things like art and music and sports and restaurants and culture and just commerce and safety and all of these things that bring people out above and beyond global warming, right? But I thought that part of me wearing something that says Baltimore or an Oriole hat or a Raven hat, whatever it would be, or even saying I'm from Baltimore, people would hold their nose up a little bit and talk about The Wire or talk about riots or talk about, oh, I hear it's not good there. I hear it's not safe. And I got tired of hearing it, hence founding Baltimore Positive. But more than that, when someone like you, who is young and educated and worldly and been around, chooses Baltimore, the more that Don and I talk to the hospital association, and especially in the middle of a pandemic, we need to make sure that Baltimore is always attracting the brightest people from the outside in. And I think we have a reputation problem that we're all trying to solve that isn't led by a murder rate every year. But when it does attract a person like you, and we're finding more and more that there are more people who said, yes, I want Baltimore before, during, or after any unrest, now or forever. But we're all here. And I do find it fascinating that people choose Baltimore, especially when they can live somewhere sunnier or someplace that sounds maybe better on the outside, but they choose Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, my response is that I want the work to do, I do, as a museum professional to matter, not only within the walls of the museum or to a broader community of peers across the world. I want it to matter very specifically for an immediate community. And I think that the vision that we have in place for this museum is a vision very specifically for Baltimore. It drives me. It creates a sense of meaning and purpose in me that's purely existential. And I don't think that I would get that from, you know, a handsomely endowed contemporary art center in a sunny location. That's not what I was after. I was after a place where I could make meaning with the artists that I think are most important working today. And the DNA of that kind of thinking, funnily enough, goes all the way back to the Cone sisters. And when they were collecting works by Matisse, he had absolutely no reputation in the United States. That was a completely vanguard enterprise. They were being led by European intellectuals. They were collecting things that they had a passion for. They brought them all back to Baltimore, and thankfully, the museum had the good sense in 1949 to accept that collection. But it was absolutely renegade thinking. And I think I want to be in a space that embraces the possibility of that risk and all the rewards in taking that risk and using it to connect art with a city. And I do believe that we can be instrumental in changing the course of people's lives.
Renegade thinking.
You can hear, Chris, in your voice, your love for this museum. I'm going to ask you what I imagine is a pretty difficult question.
Yeah.
I always say it's like choosing among children. But if I have an hour or two, and Chris Bedford says to me, I want you to come over, and I want you to get a flavor for the BMA.
Yeah.
Where do you take me first in the museum? What exhibits do you take me first to give me a real sense of the BMA?
Well, I would probably take you to two spaces. Of course, and this is self-evident, I would take you to the Cone Collection because I think it's really important for visitors to understand that these are icons of the 20th century, but they came to the museum in a completely different way. And only over time have we understood their magnitude and their import and their transformative possibilities. Those are really the objects that give us a global reputation. And then I would take you to our changing exhibition galleries where we distort all of our resources to bring the most important art from across time to our visitors. So between those two spaces, I think you feel the kind of pulse of the BMA.
Now, do we get to stop by Gertrude's and get some of John Shields' great food as well while we're there?
Gertrude's is absolutely mandatory. It's another jewel in our crown, not to mention the gift shop. The whole experience, it could occupy an entire day and a really pleasant one.
Chris, a different time here with COVID. Obviously, we wish we were fine at you in better circumstances. Some thoughts about this time and connecting with what you're doing and... I would say more than anything, and I live at the Inner Harbor, and I live up in the sky, and I see spring coming, and I watch the sun rise, and I watch it set, and I don't leave. And there is an art to it, just be looking out the window every day. If you go to my Instagram or my Facebook, you'll see I have my own color about how life goes. But I would think where that space is and all the vibrancy and springtime and the university, all the action that's there, this is a strange time to be a museum sitting inactive, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's no question, but we are also, as an institution, as an industry, blessed with extraordinary creative people from the top of the structure to the bottom of the structure. So the question becomes not to focus so much on what we can't do, but how can we take those core values that subtend everything that an institution is and make it as accessible as possible in the moment where access is next to impossible? So we're thinking about those things all the time, and obviously digital platforms are a big part of that, but being inventive in that space, I think, is important. Bringing it to people so that they don't have to search it out. Making plans and appropriate plans for a moment of reopening and reentry that will make people feel comfortable in our space, give people the sense that we made it for them, I think is enormously important. And then we have a big investment in needs and meeting the needs of day-to-day people, and with a particular emphasis on those local artists that have been such staunch supporters of our direction as an institution. So we're thinking about ways to meet their needs creatively in this interim period of time as well. So I try to focus less on what we can't do and more what we can preserve in this very difficult phase.
Well, building on that, Chris, you sound sold on Baltimore at this point, which we love, and Baltimore positive. Assuming that Chris Bedford's 3.5 years grows into 15 or 20, what is the growth of the museum? What do you see as you look 10, 15 years out for the BMA? Where does it go? What does it look like as it evolves?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So like all institutions, but maybe a little bit more pressing in our case, we need a lot more space to show work and engage our audiences and become completely permeable to the city. So we need more and more and more. So we have 96,000 objects in our collection. We show less than 1% of that on a day-to-day basis.
Wow.
So we're building centers that allow us to more frequently rotate those collections. We're building centers for scholarship so that we can telegraph those efforts to the world. Coming up in the fall of 2021, we're dedicating a center for the study of Matisse. So this is a historic moment for the BMA. It was very generously supported by an extraordinary local foundation. So we're fortunate to have the deepest, greatest holdings of that artist's work in the world. And we want to telegraph that fact and also telegraph the fact that we are the center for the study of quite possibly the most important European artist of the 20th century. And to me, gestures like that and many more of them over 10 or 20 years will participate substantially in the reemergence of this city as a cultural capital. And I think that's the big objective. Very few, nowhere else can say that they're the home of Matisse's work, not even an institution in France. So, along with the Ravens, along with the Orioles, that this is a city of Matisse. And I think that's an extraordinary claim to make.
Well, that's awesome.
Well, I
like
intrigued,
that.
Chris. You, as part of what you've been doing, and I think consistent with that theme that you just mentioned, you had made some efforts to actually take art out to the community. I noticed at one point you had actually taken some artwork to one of our favorite places, Lexington Market. Is that something, that kind of outreach still in the cards for the BMA?
Absolutely. So that concept of the mothership and branches is something we're really developing as part of our long-term planning. So BMA Lexington Market is a project that we are fully committed to and will remain in place. And I view Lexington Market as a great meeting place of all cultures from all across the city. So people from Roland Park and Homeland go there, presumably because they want Fadley's or something else. People from the local community go there to do day-to-day shopping. People from the Inner Harbor go there, and it's a great sort of, you know, crossroads of the whole city of Baltimore. So we wanted to be in that space where city residents could, and people from the county, quite frankly, could have a serendipitous encounter with art in a way that's a little bit more challenging in the mothership in Remington. So that idea of art for everyone in the space where everybody goes, hugely important. That's certainly not going anywhere.
Don, I think you brought it full circle, right? Art and crab cakes together at Lexington Market, right?
Art, the BMA and Fadley's crab cakes. Now, I'm not sure if it can get more Baltimore positive than that.
Yeah, absolutely not. Together forever.
Hey,
my last thought before we let you run, I was so intrigued. I'm going to jump back to the Oberlin College days. One of the great nicknames, Nestor, you're great at sports trivia. I bet you do not know, and don't look it up.
I'm not.
The mascot for the Oberlin College football.
I should know this, but I don't know this, so go ahead.
It's the Yeoman, right, Chris?
That is absolutely correct. Correct, yeah.
Well, maybe I shouldn't Yeoman, know this.
And Nestor, even better, recently they have officially named their mascot. Chris, what is it?
I don't know.
An albino squirrel.
Oh.
I saw an albino squirrel once on the mall in Washington, D.C. A true story.
An albino squirrel, because evidently, according to Oberlin Orr, if you see an albino squirrel on the campus, it brings you good luck. So Chris played for the Oberlin Yeoman, mascotted by the albino squirrel, on his way to the BMA.
Also, you've definitely taught me something. That is not the most fearsome mascot I've ever heard of in my life.
It does not. You know, no, but I mean, look, we're from Maryland. We have turtles. I mean, they snap at you,
right.
So it's not.
But they snap at you.
I went to Dundalk High School. We were the Fighting Owls. You know, we gave a hoot. You know what I mean? Chris, it was a pleasure to have you on, and I hope that we can get together and be at least 5.5, maybe 4.5 feet apart at Gertrude's, having a beverage and a sandwich, something soon. Really appreciate you. And we're going to send everybody out to the BMA website, artbma.org. During this COVID time and the crisis, you can find all sorts of artistic expressions and backgrounds and collections and all of that coming to life. And last thing for you, has this period cost you any collection that will be moving elsewhere? Will everything still be intact? Let's say if 30, 60, 90 days from now, we can then come back to the museum?
Absolutely. Still perfectly intact. Nothing has changed. In fact, all of those 10 exhibitions that were open for only 3 days, we're looking at the possibility of extending all of them. So when you come back, the museum will be extremely, extremely active, and we cannot wait.
Appreciate you very much. Don Mahler, Baltimore County Executive, joining us here on Baltimore Positive. We're not concluding Arts Week. We have a lot more art to get to here before it's all over with. We're also going to be rolling out some hospitals, some other Baltimore business executives, as well as keeping up on the mayor's race. Nobody's going to be following that. Now a mail-in as well. I hope we have a post office. Don and I will be getting together on that later in the week. And some surprises here at Baltimore Positive as well. You can find me anytime, Ness, at BaltimorePositive.com, as well as at WNST.net and our buyatoyota.com audio vault. We're keeping calm, we're staying local, and we're always Baltimore Positive.